Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231 and it is November 17th. And you have a test next time in class. So let's see, what chapters are going to be on this test? It's going to be chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 18. All right, so those are the chapters starting with 13, which is central nervous system, 14 is peripheral nervous system, 15 is autonomic nervous system, 16 is special senses, and then the heart. That's what's going to be on the test. Okay, I had some questions about nuclei in the brainstem. That was one of the assigned study questions. And I guess there's a big, long list of nuclei that are in the brainstem. But the things that I want you to know in the brainstem are the respiratory center is there. The cardioregulatory center is in the brainstem. The vasomotor center is in the brainstem. And then the reticular activating system is in the brainstem. And each one of those are comprised of many different nuclei, and I don't want you to get into that kind of detail. Okay, so with that central nervous system chapter, there is a lot more detail in that chapter than what you really have to know. So really just kind of follow along with what I'm presenting in lecture. Okay? Okay, and then at the end of this chapter, we have a couple things in the brainstem with regard to regulating the heart that I want you to know. So I'll make note of those. Okay, so we're almost done with the heart chapter. And we talked about the fibrous skeleton. I'll show you that again. We'll review that in just a little bit. Is there any other questions? Are there any other questions regarding the test coming up? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can make a little list right here on the board. Nuclei, or centers in the brainstem that are very important. We have the respiratory centers. And I'll just say center, but there are a number of them there. All right, the cardio, what does this regulate?
Heart
cardio regulatory center. Respiratory vasomotor center. Because our blood vessels, like our eyes, can constrict or dilate. And that helps regulate blood pressure. And then what is the other one? The reticular activating system. Or sometimes we call it the reticular formation. What's the function of the reticular formation?
Maintains
a wakeful state and is involved with diurnal cycles along with your pineal gland. Okay, but mostly it maintains a wakeful state. And if there's a lesion in the brainstem affecting the reticular activating system, you might not be able to stay awake all day long. You might just fall asleep at a second. That's called narcolepsy. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's see. Anything else? Any other questions? Yeah. Lateral spinal thalamic tract is what I'm interested in. You should be able to, if I give you the name of a tract, tell me if it's an afferent or efferent tract. Okay? So that's kind of the level. And you should know what the function of the lateral spinal thalamic tract is. Yeah. Yeah. But there, I think there is an exam figure or two exam figures regarding tracts. All right? So there's one ascending, one descending. So you should have a feel for how many neurons it takes to go up to the brain from a receptor, like using the lateral spinal thalamic tract, versus how many neurons does it take to come down from the primary motor cortex to an effector organ like skeletal muscle. Okay? Okay. Yeah?
Can you clarify the function of the sympathetic membrane versus the
Okay. So this is going to the sensors chapter, and that is sound energy is a physical wave in space as opposed to an electromagnetic wave that our eyes pick up due to light. So it's a mechanical wave, and mechanical energy, well, just like any kind of wave, has difficulty sometimes moving from one medium to another. So the sound that we hear is in air. But the medium that our inner ear is in is liquid. It's an endolymph, right? And so it's difficult for sound energy that's in air to go into sound energy within liquid, because the medium is quite a bit different. And you're probably aware of that, because if you're ever talking to anybody when you're swimming in a swimming pool, if your head's above water, you can hear them. But as soon as your head goes underwater, you can't hear them, because sound energy has difficulty getting into fluid. And so the tympanic, the ratio of the tympanic membrane to the next membrane. All right, so here's the tympanic membrane, which is right between the external ear and middle ear. All right, then we got a couple of bones in between connecting up to the inner ear right here, and there is another window right here. So as a matter of fact, you should know what that bone is. That's the stapes, yeah. Some people say stapes. I always say stapes. I'm not sure which is better. All right, the stapes has that kind of footprint. And so does that look round to you?
No,
that looks oval. So there is another membrane right here that the stapes attaches to, and that's called the oval window. All right, and so this surface area is very small of the oval window. The surface area of the tympanic membrane is very big, so this collects a lot of energy and focuses it into this very small window right here so that we don't lose sound intensity in our inner ear. So the size of the tympanic membrane compared to the oval window and the arrangement of these bones right here sort of acts like an amplifier so that sound energy can enter our ear so we can hear it. Okay, so that's probably the big thing to appreciate. So the tympanic membrane can't be smaller than the oval window, because then enough energy wouldn't get into the inner ear for us to hear anything. Okay? So that's an impedance matching device that helps that energy move into our inner ear.
So, is it safe for me to say that with the tympanic membrane that it transmits vibrations to the tiny bone in
sure.
the middle ear?
Yeah.
And then with the oval window, it transmits vibrations into the inner ear?
Yeah. So this whole system, the tympanic membrane, the incus malleus, the malleus, incus, and stapes, and the oval window, this is a way of taking sound energy that's in your external auditory meatus and transmits it efficiently into the inner ear. Okay? So this is acting like a big antenna or something, focusing that energy so that it can get into the inner ear right here. Yeah, so that's the arrangement of that. Any other questions? Okay. So, start practicing your exam figures. Okay. Because that will help with everything, I'm sure. All right. So, the heart. Let's go back to the heart now. The interesting thing about the heart, and maybe I had mentioned this, is that if we were to remove the heart from a mammal, including us, and stick it on the table or a petri dish, it wouldn't just sit there by itself still. It would actually start to contract. It would start to beat, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, so that's just not a myth, but that actually happens. And that's because the heart has its own natural rhythm. It doesn't need nerves. It doesn't need a brain to tell the heart when to contract. It has a lot of nerves, but it just regulates the heart rate. Okay, it doesn't necessarily have to tell the heart what to do. And there are special muscle cells within the heart that act as a conduction system. And it's not really neuronal tissue. They're just specialized muscle cells that have special electrical activity, and we call that the conduction system of the heart. And the first part of the heart, okay, we have nodal cells. So nodal cells have the fastest rate of depolarization, right, or the fastest electrical activity. And so these usually control the heart rate. The sinoatrial node has the fastest rate. And we call that the pacemaker of the heart. It's in the right atrium. It's autorhythmic, meaning what? That it does not need innervation to depolarize or start electrical activity. So when we look at the heart, here is the sinoatrial node, and these electrical signals then flow through both atria. Right? Because if you can remember looking at cardiac cells, what can you tell me about cardiac muscle cells? Something about their structure. They have special intercalated discs between them. So for instance, if here is one cell and here is another one right here, right, there is a special junction between them, and that intercalated discs allow for electrical information to go directly from one cardiac muscle cell to the other. So compared to skeletal muscles, which are long, cardiac muscles are short and they're branched. And another difference is that in skeletal muscle, if one skeletal muscle gets stimulated electrically someplace, maybe in your arm, only that one cell is going to depolarize and contract. But if one myocardial cell depolarizes, that electrical stimulation can flow from one cell to another laterally. But look, it's also branched so that it can also what? Move up and down within different layers of the heart too. So the sinoatrial node depolarizes and sends that electrical information through both atria. So in this particular case, because of those intercalated discs, we say that the atria act like a syncytium. They're all acting together, transmitting that electrical information, which then is a signal for these chambers to contract. When that electrical signal reaches this region right here, it's delayed a little bit. So this is just a little station where the electrical signal is delayed before it's passed on to the ventricles, right, via the atrioventricular bundle right here. And remember, when we looked at the fibrous skeleton of the heart, right at the, like the coronary sulcus or the atrioventricular sulcus right here, that connective tissue does not allow for, does not allow for electrical signals to pass from the atria, which would be up over here, pass through the fibrous skeleton into the ventricles. So there has to be a special pathway. All right, so what is the name of that special pathway? That is the atrioventricular bundle. Some specialized muscle fibers take the electrical signal into the ventricle, and that electrical signal then moves down the bundle branches, the right and left bundle branch, very, very quickly, all the way to the apex of the heart. And then the electrical signal is spread through the free walls of the ventricles and stimulates the myocardial cells to contract via these Purkinje fibers. So this is the conduction system of the heart. Right, the normal pacemaker is the SA node. The electrical signal moves to the AV node, and there it's stopped for about a quarter of a second, and then that electrical signal moves very, very fast down to the apex, and then these Purkinje fibers stimulate the ventricles to contract. So the electrical signals are not the physical contraction of the heart, because that's a mechanical event. That's the muscle proteins actually shortening the muscle fibers or the muscle cells, the cardiac muscle cells. But the electrical signals are what? Are what starts that activity. So this is good because since the sinoatrial node is in the atria contract first. And that's important because when the atria contract, they force blood through the AV valves into the ventricle. So they help load the ventricles up with blood because remember, when the heart contracts, there has to be blood in the ventricles so that when the ventricles contract, blood can be ejected from the heart. All right, then the signal comes all the way down to the apex, and this is where the heart starts to contract from next. The apical regions, not the basal regions of the heart. Because how does blood get out of a ventricle? It has to leave through a? Yeah, through a valve, a semilunar valve. And these valves are way up here at the base of the heart. So if the base of the heart was to contract first, it would have a tendency to squish blood, which way? Down into the apex. And could it leave the heart once it's in the apex? It can't. All right, so this electrical signal moves very fast through the AV bundle, and the bundle branches down to the apex so that the apex, when it starts to contract, squishes blood up toward the base of the heart and out through the semilunar valves. So that's the normal contraction. of the heart. So first blood gets pumped into the ventricle because of the SA node. And when the ventricles fill up with blood, this part contracts first, pushing blood up toward the base and into the aorta or the pulmonary trunk. And that's how we get a nice ejection of blood from the heart. Okay, so the last fibers to depolarize are the Purkinje fibers. The first ones are the sinoatrial node. And remember, signals can't get easily from the atria into the ventricles, but only through this little pathway right here. And sometimes if somebody has a heart attack in this region and this pathway is killed, then their heart beats at two different rhythms. The atria will have one rhythm and the ventricles will have another rhythm. That's usually not life-threatening because the job of the atria is not very important in humans. Okay? As blood flows into, say, the right atrium right here from the superior vena cava, most of it flows right through this atrioventricular valve, and you should be able to tell me which one this is, into the right ventricle. When the atria contract, that only adds a little bit of extra blood into the right ventricle. Okay, fibrillation is a condition where that special conduction system has been disturbed. Okay, maybe there's been a heart attack in some part of the heart, maybe like that AV node, so that the signals between the atria and ventricles get lost. All right, or maybe, for instance, some other part of the heart, because it's ischemic, some of the blood supply is cut off to it, it becomes very irritable and it starts acting like a pacemaker. So now the heart has two pacemakers, and this is very confusing for the heart, and that might cause the heart to go into fibrillation. So the normal electrical activity of the heart kind of looks like this. This is what we call an EKG. And this is a very nice normal rhythm. But if the electrical activity can start to wander around inside the heart, because remember, we said that if we cause one cell within the heart to depolarize, where does that electrical activity go? It can go everywhere around the heart. All right, so if the sinoatrial node and some other place of the heart start to misbehave, these electrical signals, right, if there is an ectopic pacemaker someplace in the heart, these electrical signals then can start to wander around inside the heart, causing maybe one little pathway to contract. Right, and then a little pathway up over here and then down over here. So that contraction will wander around the heart, and as the contraction is wandering around the heart, it's not contracting with a lot of force, it's not pumping blood. And when your heart stops pumping blood, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? Yeah, about 3 seconds. Okay, and then after that, what happens to the brain if the heart doesn't start beating normally again? It dies after what period of time? About 3 minutes, right? So what that electrical activity looks like, since it's wandering around the heart kind of aimlessly, this is what the electrical activity of the heart looks like when it's in ventricular fibrillation. So the heart is working, the heart is contracting, it's using up energy, it's gobbling up ATP, but it's not contracting in the right way to pump blood. Right, that's very dangerous circumstance, not only for the brain but for the heart, because it's using up the energy necessary for contraction. Okay, so that is fibrillation. And the best way out of that is to, is to shock the heart electrically with external voltage so that the whole heart contracts as one unit, and that so it stops fibrillating, it contracts, and then hopefully after the whole heart is contracted, it goes back to its normal rhythm again. And a lot of times it does. Okay, one last thing about the heart, and that is innervation. The heart can be regulated with two different nervous systems. These both belong to the autonomic nervous system, which means that you don't have control of it. It takes care of itself automatically. And the information comes from the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. So we had just talked about that in the brainstem. And The two divisions are the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. And the parasympathetic has chronotropic effects. What does chrono mean? What does it have to do with? Time. Like some people wear a watch, they don't call it a watch, they call it a chronometer or a chronograph. Okay, so chrono has to do with time. So parasympathetic stimulation adjusts the heart rate because it sends nerve fibers to the SA node as well as the AV node. Right? But what's another name for the SA node? That's a pacemaker. Right? So when, and in particular the vagus nerve is the parasympathetic outflow to the heart, when it releases acetylcholine on the SA node, that slows the heart rate down. That's a parasympathetic effect. And as a matter of fact, maybe in your notes, you might want to say negative chronotropic effect. Because that's going to do what? That's going to slow the heart down. Sympathetic, on the other hand, okay, is going to speed the heart up. That comes from the cardioacceleratory center in the medulla. Via what? Thoracic outflow, via the sympathetic chain and ganglia, via the sympathetic cardiac nerve to the heart. And sympathetic activity on the heart is a little bit different. It's the same, all right, because in one sense is that it has chronotropic effects. It speeds the heart up, which is different than what? Slowing the heart down. It's antagonistic, but that's already something you know about the autonomic nervous system. So instead of having a negative chronotropic effect, we're going to say that sympathetic stimulation has a positive chronotropic effect. It's going to speed the heart rate up, both at the SA node and conduction through the AV node. But the sympathetic innervation also has something else, and that is it can adjust the force of contraction. And that's what we call an inotropic effect, a force of contraction. Notice that the parasympathetic doesn't affect the force of contraction, only the heart rate. Sympathetic has a positive inotropic effect. So for instance, when you get scared to death, what happens to your heart? It not only speeds up, but you can probably feel that thing pounding inside your chest, all right, because the force of contraction also increases. And that's what we call the inotropic effect, the positive inotropic effect of sympathetic stimulation. So that's a kind of distinguishes itself from the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's pretty much it for the heart. Okay, but I think I do want to do a little exercise on the board, just for fun. So let's see if I can write this question down, and then let's see if you guys can answer it. And it has to do with the heart and the circulations. How many different circulations do we have in the body? Yeah, I would say two. What are they? The systemic and pulmonary circulation. Okay. So a nice thing that we can do in anatomy is trace how things move. Like you should be able to trace an electrical signal through the conduction system of the heart. Where is the usual place for an electrical stimulus, impulse to start in the heart? That's the SA node, right? That's a pacemaker. And then it goes through the atria to the AV node, AV bundle, then the bundle branch and all that to the Purkinje. Okay, so, but in this particular case, let's trace a drop of blood. Okay, so, trace a drop of blood, and I'm going to abbreviate through the heart and circulations, okay, noting all chambers, valves, great vessels, not little vessels, but great vessels coming off the base of the heart. All right, great vessels. Great vessels. So you got to know the difference between an artery and a vein. Period. Okay, tell which vessels carry oxygen or CO2, and state where exchange takes place. Okay. All right, so you should have a little picture in your mind of how this stuff is going. And where should we start? Superior Vena Cava. Okay, start with SVC. Okay, so if you want to draw a diagram, I suppose that's okay. Okay, so if you want to draw a nice diagram, that might help. How many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? Okay, so here we got some valves right here. And, but you should also be able to do this. Okay, just a nice picture in your mind. And we want to start where? Right here. Superior vena cava. All right, so I'm going to abbreviate it. Superior vena cava. And is that an artery or a vein?
Vein.
Why is that a vein? It's bringing blood to the heart, right? All right, so that's a vein. So don't forget, it's not in the name. So let's put vein right here. Is that oxygenated or relatively deoxygenated blood? So I'm going to just write a little symbol down, CO2, saying that it's relatively deoxygenated or relatively high in CO2. All right, so after the SVC, where does it go to?
Right atrium.
All right, right atrium. What about the blood? CO2 or O2? CO2. So I'm going to just put some quotations right here. Let me just copy it down to the next line. All right, right atrium. After that, where does blood go?
Tricuspid.
Atrioventricular valve. Right. And what about the blood? It's the same. All right. After the tricuspid, it's the RV. What about the blood?
Still
deoxygenated. From the right ventricle, where does it go?
Pulmonary
trunk. All right. And it's deoxygenated. Pulmonary trunk takes blood to the
lungs.
To the lungs. So let's put lungs here just for fun. Oh, you're very good. Okay, so we have right ventricle, pulmonary trunk, but we've got the, all right, I'm just going to pulmonary semilunar valve lungs in here. Yeah, okay. That's this one right here. Okay, pulmonary semilunar valve, pulmonary trunk, lungs. Okay, what happens in the lungs?
Oxygenation.
Yeah, so here, Let's put capillaries. So CO2 out, O2 in. This right here is what we call what? Exchange. Exchange takes place. All right, so what's another name for pulmonary trunk? Let's just say pulmonary artery right here. Pulmonary artery. So beware, in this pulmonary artery, it is still what? Deoxygenated blood. Because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. All right, so then, what do we got after the lungs? After the capillaries in the lungs, we got the?
Pulmonary veins.
And what's in these pulmonary veins? Now we're back to oxygenated blood. Pulmonary veins come back to the heart, and in particular, the left atrium, and it's still oxygenated. Left atrium. Okay, so we're in the left atrium. Don't forget we got to go through that AV valve, which is what? The bicuspid AV valve. It's oxygenated. And so I'm going to come up over here. So the bicuspid goes into the left ventricle. That's got oxygen. Left ventricle. Close. But somebody's checking us out here, so we got to get this right. Aortic semilunar valve, right? Don't forget that semilunar valve is still oxygenated into the aorta. That's oxygenated. Then we've got systemic capillaries. Okay, what happens here? Exchange. Yeah. O2 out. CO2 in. All right, so after these capillaries, where to? How about the superior vena cava / inferior vena cava? Depends on where that blood went to, right? If it went to the heart, it'd be coming back. And then it just starts all over again, and this is high in CO2. Okay, so it's handy for you to be able to diagram that. If you can do that in like 2 minutes or something, or a minute, probably a minute after you do it a number of times, that would be great. So that really shows you the two circulations. Okay? Okay. So that now is it for the heart. Unless somebody's got some questions. Any questions on that? Okay. So you can quiz each other when you do that in lab or something, right? So that should really just be second nature to you. Yeah. Okay, after the aorta, because the coronary arteries are in this circulation right here. This one right here. So systemic circulation, including coronaries. Okay, are part of the systemic circulation. So they don't fit into the aorta. They're right at the base of the aorta, right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve, at the first part of the ascending aorta. Okay? So they're not pulmonary circulation. So you can see that the arrangement is opposite between the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation. So you can't define an artery or a vein by what the condition of the blood is, only the direction of blood flow with respect to the heart. All right, so that didn't take too long. That was good. Okay. So let's move on to blood vessels. All right, so this is not on the test. All right, circulation is not on the test. Chapter 19. So this is just what we were sort of doing already, okay, if we have a blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart, we call that an artery, right? And then blood is going to flow into smaller and smaller arteries until it gets into the smallest vessels in your circulatory system. And these are capillaries. This is where exchange can take place. And then blood is going to flow into bigger and bigger blood vessels, right? Finally into a vein that's going to take it back to the heart. So this is an interesting picture because it shows some very nice anatomy of these different blood vessels. All right, so when a blood vessel branches, okay, like right here from a large artery to smaller and smaller, we call that a bifurcation. All right, so these branches are what we call a bifurcation. But we see other branches here as well on the venous side of this capillary. So small blood vessels branch together, come together to form bigger and bigger veins. So that's not a bifurcation. That's what we call an anastomosis. Okay, so a bifurcation and anastomosis have some connotation of blood flow through them. All right, so let me close this one down so I'm not too confused here. Go to this one. Okay, and one thing that students typically aren't too interested in anatomy are layers of things. But layers of things are very, very important because when something goes wrong, physicians will always want to know what layers are involved to find out what the extent of the pathology is. So to stage diseases, it's very important to know what the normal layers of any kind of tissue are. And when you can understand how pathology has invaded different layers, then you know how to treat that particular kind of pathology And you also get information on what the prognosis is going to be. So when you see the involvement of layers, you know a lot about the disease process in terms of treatment and then the potential outcomes. That's what prognosis means. What is going to be the outcome for this individual? And there is a lot of cardiovascular disease just involving blood vessels, which involve these different layers. And so a tunic is just a covering that you can put on. So a coat sometimes is just a tunic. And a blood vessel is broken down into three different tunics or three different layers. The tunica externa, which is the outside or most superficial layer. The tunica intima is the innermost layer. And then you got a layer in between, which is called the tunica media. Right? The tunica externa is mostly connective tissue with a lot of collagen. And some have elastic fibers as well. This makes the wall very strong, and it helps anchor the vessel to surrounding body parts. And in some very large vessels, they even have their own blood supply. Some vessels are so large, so thick, that they even have their own blood supply. We call that the vasovasorum. And large vessels have their own blood supply. The tunica media has muscle, smooth muscle. For what? For constriction. And when that smooth muscle relaxes, it causes vasodilation. And there's some elastic connective tissue as well. The tunica intima is the simplest layer. And that just has a single layer of a simple squamous epithelium. And this lines the tube. And the inside diameter of that tube is what we call the lumen of that tube. All right, so let's take a look at some of these. All right, let's start with an artery. And we see, okay, that the tunica externa right here is connective tissue and maybe a little bit of elastic tissue. The tunica media has smooth muscle, right? And then maybe another internal layer of elastic tissue. And then the last layer is the tunica intima, just a simple squamous epithelium. All right, so if you look at all these different layers, right, we see that arteries are very, very thick because they contain a lot of elastic tissue and a very thick layer of muscle. And that's important because the blood pressure in arteries is the highest. So these blood vessels have to be very thick just to hold on to that pressure. Okay, and do you see any valves in this artery right here? No, it's just a patent open tube just for conducting blood through an artery. All right, and then there are branches. This would be an example, for instance, of an arteriole. It's going to have less smooth muscle, okay, less elastic tissue compared to this large artery right here, but still a lot of smooth muscle. So arterioles can constrict and dilate. That's going to control blood flow to various organs. And these arterioles are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller and finally end up in a capillary. All right, so here is a pretty nice diagram of a capillary. Here is the hollow center of that tube, which is what we call the lumen. And a capillary is made up of just one simple squamous epithelium. So it's a very, very thin layer and even a thinner basement membrane. So because this tube right here is so thin, this is the reason why things can enter and leave the cardiovascular system. So oxygen can leave, right, like from in the tissues, leave the blood and go into the tissues in the systemic circulation because the wall thickness is so thin. Oxygen can't get through an artery, so there's no way for oxygen to leave. So if you have oxygen in this artery, it can't leave the circulatory system until it gets to the capillary right here. Right? So, for instance, if somebody's heart stops beating, right, in all these arteries, there's oxygenated blood, but that oxygen in the arteries can't help the person unless it can get to a capillary bed right here. So what can we do for somebody whose heart has stopped beating? Yeah, you can do chest compressions, right? And all that oxygenated blood in their arteries will slowly perfuse these capillaries right here and will give up oxygen, right, to maintain that person's brain and their heart until we can get their heart started again. All right, so if those of you that are following CPR rules and regulations, a number of years ago, there was one technique that was emphasized, and now it's really de-emphasized, and the latest I heard is that you don't even do them anymore, and that is breaths for people, because it's more important, because if you're not perfusing, if you're not moving blood through the system, even though you're helping somebody inflate their lungs, that oxygen isn't getting to their tissues. So now it's more important to move blood through their circulatory system than even help somebody inhale, right? So breathing is de-emphasized. Chest compressions are emphasized to help deliver this oxygen to the tissues.
I think they changed it from 15 to 2 to 30 to 2.
Oh, breaths?
Well, 30 chest compressions to 2 breaths. They used to be 15 to 2 breaths.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that maybe has changed even more recently.
Yeah, more compressions to breaths
even. So, well, good luck with that because it's really hard to do chest compressions to do that. So, so hopefully you can do some team effort with that. Yeah, so chest compressions are by far the most important thing. And even though somebody's brain might die after 3 minutes, don't stop doing chest compressions after 3 minutes. Okay, just keep it up because you're probably preserving that person's brain by doing chest.
Now a lot of businesses, when it happens, there's a lot of
AEDs.
AEDs, right.
Okay, automatic electronic defibrillators. And there's some even on campus, though I don't know where they are. Yeah. If somebody knows where they are and give me that list, I would put it in the notes. And actually, I might move the lecture to that room. But an automatic electronic defibrillator is kind of smart because when you put the electrodes on somebody, it can measure this. Oops. This is what? A normal ECG. And it won't shock the person. But if it measures electrical activity like that, what is that? That's fibrillation. Then it will shock the person and hopefully revert back to this normal rhythm right here. Okay, but you shouldn't shock a heart unless it is in fibrillation. So the machine is pretty smart to make that diagnosis. Because if you're in a normal rhythm and you shock somebody, guess what it can produce? It can produce fibrillation, depending on exactly when in the heart cycle that person is shocked. So you have to be kind of smart about that. The machine is smart enough. And as a matter of fact, I know some people that have defibrillators implanted in their chest. So it's continuously monitoring their heart, and if it goes into fibrillation, it will shock them. And I think our vice president at the moment has one of those fancy devices, an AED in his chest. Okay.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, you could tell. If the person is talking, they'll stop talking, I'm sure, and they'll catch their breath. And it's not as violent a shock as when somebody has external paddles put on them, but it's still probably really obnoxious and something that if you weren't worrying about dying, you wouldn't want to go through it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's pretty wild, but it does save a lot of people's lives. Okay, so capillaries, exchange can take place in capillaries. So what's a good reason why? What is your understanding? Why can exchange take place in capillaries? Because they're really thin. And as a matter of fact, maybe in the next chapter, this chapter, we're going to see that there's different kinds of capillaries. Some capillaries even are leaky. So we even classify capillaries by the degree at which they even leak fluid out of them. All right, but basically, your understanding is right. Exchange takes place in the capillary because the wall is very thin. All right, so then capillaries and anastomose to form small veins or venules, and venules and anastomose to form small veins, and small veins and anastomose to form larger veins. All right, so here's a large vein, but nonetheless, it still has all three of those layers, smooth muscle, right, and elastic tissue, and the thickness of this vessel right here is still way too thick to allow for exchange to take place. And the other thing that you might notice is that the inside, the lumen of a vein, has some structure to it. Look up over here, okay? And that is a valve. So valves and veins allow blood flow to only go back to the heart and not back to the tissues right? It keeps blood flowing in an antegrade fashion. That means back to the heart and not a retrograde pathway, which means back to the tissue. Because pressure in veins is very, very low, and blood would have a tendency to move forwards and backwards in a vein. Not so in an artery because there's such a high pressure. Okay. So types of blood vessels. Arteries. Takes blood away from the heart. That's a nice review. It may be oxygenated or deoxygenated. Give me a name of an artery that's deoxygenated. Pulmonary artery. All right. It has the highest pressure. And that's because that when the heart contracts, that imparts a lot of pressure to that blood. There is an elastic layer, especially in large arteries. We call these conducting arteries near the heart. Give me the name of an elastic conducting artery near the heart.
Aorta,
perfect example. Pulmonary trunk, pulmonary arteries. So when the heart contracts, the aorta actually expands. And when the heart relaxes, the aorta then constricts back down to its normal diameter because of that elastic component. And that helps maintain blood pressure during diastole of the heart. Now, did we define what those terms meant, systole and diastole? Yeah, diastole. Systole is when the heart contracts. Diastole is when the heart relaxes. Those are the two parts of the heart cycle. The muscle layer in medium and small arteries, these are what we call distributing arteries because they can vasodilate or vasoconstrict. When they vasodilate, right, then that means more blood flow will go through those blood vessels. When they vasoconstrict, then that impedes blood flow and that blood is going to go to some other part of your body. Okay, so remember that blood can't go every place in your body all at one time. We don't have enough blood, so that under a stressful situation, blood will want to go to your muscles so that you can run away, for instance. But what about blood flow to your digestive tract? It's going to be decreased. Right, because that's probably the last thing that your body is interested in at that particular time. All right, if we look at the diameter of a blood vessel with this top row of numbers right here, so let's change the diameter of a blood vessel, 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, and let's look at the blood flow through that particular vessel and see how it changes. Notice that it's not a simple one-to-one correspondence. As the diameter increases, guess what happens to the flow? It goes up a lot faster by a factor of 16. If we triple the diameter of a blood vessel, it goes up by a factor of 81. So small changes in the diameter or the radius of a blood vessel imparts a huge change in the amount of blood flow to a particular organ. All right, so we call that the fourth power rule. So for instance, if we double the radius or diameter of a blood vessel, the blood flow doesn't go up by a factor of 2, it goes up by 2 times 2, which is 4, times 2 is 8, and then times 2 again, which is 16. So we call that the fourth power rule. So that's a very efficient way that your body can regulate blood flow through different areas by vasoconstriction or vasodilation. And arterioles are even more specialized than medium and small arteries for controlling blood flow via vasodilation or vasoconstriction via this fourth power rule right here. And this is what the vasomotor center in the brainstem is doing. It's controlling blood flow through various parts of our body by causing vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Okay. The next thing is on the way to a capillary where exchange takes place, there is a pre-capillary sphincter. All right, so what the heck is a sphincter? You're familiar with an orbicularis. What's an orbicularis? Like around your eye and around your mouth, orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris. Those are skeletal muscles, right, that can close your eyelids, close your mouth. All right, but a sphincter is a smooth muscle. It's a circular smooth muscle, and it has special properties of constricting. And if it constricts, it will cut off blood supply to a capillary. And when it dilates, it opens up blood supply to a capillary. So a precapillary sphincter controls blood flow into a capillary bed via local control, which means that when metabolites build up in the tissue, that's going to regulate the vasodilation or vasoconstriction of that precapillary sphincter. It is not innervated, so your brain can't control precapillary sphincters. They're controlled by the metabolism within the tissue that we find them. So let's see what I have. So precapillary sphincters are going to be located in this region, right about in this region where I have the cursor right now. Okay, so here we have pretty much that same diagram, but now we can see these sphincters of smooth muscle right at the entrance to a capillary. So in the top example right here, they're opened or dilated, and that allows for perfusion of this capillary bed. But for instance, if this tissue, say if this tissue was a muscle and it's quiet, it's not working, it's not going to be producing things like lactic acid, it's not going to be producing things like carbon dioxide. And since it's not producing those things, that's going to cause these precapillary sphincters to constrict. All right? And as soon as that muscle starts to work and it's producing acids like lactic acid and CO2, that's going to have an effect on these precapillary sphincters to do what? To relax and dilate. All right? So when that muscle starts to work, then blood flow is reestablished in those muscles to perfuse it so that it can stay alive and healthy. And that's pretty much the reason why your mother always said right after lunch, what? You can't go swimming. Because when you start to use all those muscles in your body, these precapillary sphincters and muscles are going to open up, and that's going to divert blood from your intestines where you have just eaten that big meal, right? And that could produce cramping, for instance. And if you're swimming, of course, that could kill you. Okay. All right, so here are the three different kinds of capillaries. And we have a continuous capillary, we have a sinusoidal capillary, and we have a fenestrated capillary. So the continuous capillary, notice that there are junctions between cells that we call a tight junction, but still fluid can leak out of a capillary. Here we have a red blood cell and then plasma within this capillary, so that plasma can actually leak out and bring oxygen and nutrients to tissues. Right, here is what we call a fenestrated capillary because the endothelium even has big holes right through it that allows for even more exchange to take place. This capillary is leakier. And then in a couple parts of the body, notice there are big spaces between the cells, and even within the cells of the endothelium, this allows for a massive amount of fluid to move out of a capillary. But these holes still aren't big enough for cells, like red blood cells, to leak out. All right, only fluid, and maybe some kinds of white blood cells. All right, and even in this particular case, the basement membrane is incomplete. So we're going to look at a couple different places of your body that have these different kinds of capillaries. Okay, so here you got continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. Venules that as capillaries, anastomose that forms venules, and as venules come together, they form veins, which bring blood back to the heart, maybe oxygenated or deoxygenated. Like, give me an example of an oxygenated vein. That's a good example of a vein that's oxygenated. But I heard somebody say aorta. I probably wouldn't pick that one first because that's an artery. But, for instance, pulmonary vein, okay, would be a great example. The highest blood pressure we find in arteries. The lowest blood pressure we find in veins, okay? And the way that a fluid will flow, whether an air is a fluid, a gas is a fluid, or a liquid is a fluid. So, for instance, if in your tire you want to put air in your tire, where do you need higher pressure? Inside the tire or in your pump? In the pump, right? So a fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure, and that includes the fluid in your cardiovascular system. And so veins have to have the lowest pressure. I know a lot of students like to say when I ask them, the lowest pressure is in capillaries. Okay, and I think they're getting confused because capillaries are very special because what happens in the capillary? Exchange, but capillaries don't have the lowest pressure because if they did, blood in veins would flow where? Instead of to the heart, it would flow to a capillary, from a vein to a capillary. Blood would also flow from an artery to a capillary, right? And then you wouldn't have blood circulating through your body. So the lowest pressure is in a vein so that blood drains from capillaries into veins and then back to the heart. Okay. So there are a couple things that help bring blood back to the heart. There are things that sort of act like pumps along the route that a vein has to take. So for instance, if you have a vein in your forearm right here, and you contract all those muscles in your forearm, what happens to the pressure in your forearm? You know what? It goes way up because all those muscles are squeezing down on those veins, pressurizing the blood in the veins, right? So if this area is pressurized, blood will want to squirt back down to my hand and then back up to my heart. But which way should blood go in a vein when you contract the muscle? It should go back to the heart. So what's preventing blood from going back to an extremity when a skeletal muscle contracts? There are valves in veins. That's right. So don't forget, there are valves made up of two flaps of endothelium so that when some part of your body contracts, blood can only flow back to the heart, can't flow back to an extremity if those valves are working properly. Now, of course, that doesn't always mean that they'll work properly in some people, right? Because, let's take a look at a vein. Oops. All right, so here's this valve right here. They only have a certain length. Some people's veins actually start to dilate so much that these valves can't touch each other anymore. And so they can't stop blood from flowing backwards or retrograde. For instance, when somebody has varicose veins in their legs, the valves can't approximate each other anymore, and so they don't act like valves, so blood will have a tendency to pool in their lower or in their extremities, mostly in their legs. All right, so that's why we need to know something about the different layers even of blood vessels, because it tells us a lot about how to help and treat people. Okay, another mechanism that helps blood return to the heart has to do with your thoracic cavity. So remember we said a fluid, like a gas or liquid, will flow from different regions of pressure. So how will a fluid flow according to pressure? From high to low or low to high? Always from high to low, right? And so air is a fluid and it flows into our lungs. When can air flow into our lungs? When the pressure in our lungs is higher than the air or lower than the air pressure? It's got to be lower than air pressure, right? Because if air is flowing into our lungs, it's got to be lower air pressure in our lungs. And we adjust the pressure of our lungs by expanding our thoracic cage, by depressing the diaphragm. That increases the volume, decreasing the pressure, so air flows into our lungs. But not only air flows into our thoracic cavity, what else will flow in when the pressure is reduced? Blood from different parts of our body. So when we inhale, when we expand our thoracic cavity, air flows into our lungs, but blood also flows back to our thoracic cavity when we take an inhalation, right, when we expand our rib cage. So those two mechanisms, one we call the skeletal muscle pump, and the other is what we call the respiratory pump, keeps blood moving through veins, even though it's very low pressure, back to our heart. I don't think I have a picture of that anywhere. Well, here's a picture of the what? Skeletal muscle pump. When these two skeletal muscles contract, it squeezes this vein, pressurizes this blood in the vein, and it's going to want to squirt away from these two muscles, but since a vein has these valves, it can only squirt back to the heart. So that's a skeletal muscle pump. Okay. All right, so we're familiar with the circulations already, so we're kind of moving on to the circulations. All right, so we're familiar with this. The right ventricle pumps blood into the, which circulation, systemic or pulmonary? Pulmonary circulation past the pulmonary semilunar valve into the pulmonary trunk. And then that bifurcates very early on into the right and left pulmonary arteries. Now, are these high in oxygen or high in CO2, these arteries right here? High in CO2 because they're going to the lungs, all right, for exchange. Excuse me, guys. Got a question? Okay. And then, of course, in the capillaries, CO2 leaves, oxygen enters, and then that returns to the heart via the four pulmonary veins to the left atrium. Right? And so, again, you could answer this question very easily. The four pulmonary veins are high in oxygen, high in O2. Okay, so here's the trunk, the right and left pulmonary arteries. The right branch bifurcates underneath the arch of the aorta, and you can see where exchange takes place, coming back via these four pulmonary veins. Okay, so let's go on to the systemic circulation. Divisions of the aorta. You have the first division, the ascending aorta, then you have the arch of the aorta, and then the descending. And the descending is going to come down about in this region right here. And be aware of the branches. Do we have any branches coming off the ascending aorta? Absolutely. What are the branches of the ascending aorta? Okay, because here is the brachiocephalic that sort of looks like the arch to me. But I'm really interested first is this ascending part right here. What branches are coming off the ascending aorta? You got, yeah, the right and left coronaries that are actually feeding, right, the heart itself. And those branch from within the semilunar valve cusps, which I can't see on this diagram right here. I don't have a picture of it. Probably in the heart chapter, you have to go back and look at where the orifices are for the right and left coronary arteries. Okay, so here is the right coronary, and then here is the left coronary, and then it bifurcates to the circumflex and the left anterior descending coronary artery. And they come right from the ascending aorta. All right, the next division of the aorta is the arch. And there are some branches off the arch of the aorta. The first one, brachiocephalic. The next one is the common carotid. So we got to say common carotid because it's going to bifurcate into an internal and external in a little bit. Now, which one is this? Is this the right or the left? It's the left one. And here is the left subclavian going underneath the clavicle, taking blood to the left upper appendage. All right, so those are the three branches off the arch of the aorta, and then here is the descending aorta. The descending aorta has got two main divisions to it. The two main divisions within the thoracic cavity, that's the thoracic division, is still descending aorta, and then after going through the diaphragm, this is the abdominal aorta. That's a part of the descending aorta as well. Okay, so I don't think I'm asking you any divisions coming off the thoracic aorta. Descending thoracic abdominal. Nope. Okay. Well, so let's go back up to the arch and follow some of these blood vessels, like the brachiocephalic. All right, so here you can see, okay, brachiocephalic right here. And the brachiocephalic then bifurcates into the right common carotid and the right subclavian. And let's go down, I guess, through the arm a little bit. So then the subclavian just automatically turns into the axillary and then turns into the brachial, right? And then when it gets into the forearm, what do we have? Okay, we have the radial and ulnar. Okay, and that's good for you to know. Oh, I guess I'm clicking a plus sign. Let's go back this way. Okay, so that's the same vessel. We just give it different names depending on what body region it's in. All right, let's go back up to the head right here. All right, so the brachiocephalic, like I said, bifurcates into the subclavian. as well as the common carotid. The common carotid then is going to take blood to your head, both your superficial head as well as deep parts of your head like your brain. So here is another bifurcation between the internal carotid and the external carotid. So external feeds your scalp and facial muscles, the internal helps feed blood to the brain. There's another artery that goes to the brain, and that comes off of the subclavian. It's about the first branch after the branch from the carotid. This is called the vertebral artery, right? And the vertebral artery, you're kind of familiar with that because you studied cervical vertebrae at one time, so this is a cervical region. And in the transverse processes of a cervical vertebrae, there was a very characteristic formation that you could distinguish a cervical vertebrae from any kind of vertebra. And what was in a transverse process of a cervical? There was a foramen. Yeah, a transverse foramen. So this artery right here, the vertebral artery, passes through each one of those foramen through the transverse processes taking blood to the brain. So you have four main arteries on one and both sides of the body taking blood to the brain. Both internal carotids and both vertebral arteries taking blood to the brain. Okay, so the same thing for the left common carotid over here, and of course then the left subclavian follows the same as the right subclavian over here. So I don't want to trace those again. All right, well let's go look at that common carotid again a little bit more detail. So here, this might even be an exam figure, I'm not sure. All right, so here is the ascending, here's the arch, brachiocephalic, then the common carotid, here's the vertebral artery going through the transverse foramina up to the brain. This bifurcation between the internal and external carotid arteries, this is what we call the carotid sinus. All right, so as a matter of fact, this carotid artery right here is very big, and you can palpate that. That's another good region where you can take a pulse from somebody. But don't press it too hard, because right here in the carotid sinus, that's at the bifurcation of the common carotid and the internal external carotid, there are some very important mechanoreceptors that measure blood pressure right here. Right? And so we call those baroreceptors. And if you were to press on that carotid sinus real hard, you're going to squish those baroreceptors, and they're going to send information to the brain saying that the blood pressure in this carotid artery is way too high. So high that it might actually blow up a blood vessel in your brain or some other part of your body that's going to cause a stroke. All right, so when your brain receives information from this area because you press on it, and that information says that the pressure is way too high, how is your body going to respond? Okay, your body says, oh, pressure is way too high, we better lower the blood pressure. What's the best way to lower your blood pressure? Stop your heart from beating. Okay, so your heart is going to slow down, might even stop, and of course that's not very good, because what is your blood pressure? It's not really high, it's just you artificially stimulated those baroreceptors maybe by accident or something, and of course you would pass out, and hopefully your heart would start up again by itself and it wouldn't really kill you. I've never heard of anybody really dying except when people do surgery. I've heard of people actually dying when they were doing some kind of cervical surgery and they manipulated those baroreceptors and that caused their heart rate to bottom out, and that they weren't monitoring somebody's vital signs and they would lose that patient. Okay, so that's in this carotid sinus right here. And this is an area that has a lot of pathology as we get older. That means that it forms plaques, there are lipid deposits that develop between the layers of this blood vessel right here, and that helps plug up the blood vessels. And it can produce something called transient ischemic attacks, where somebody might forget who they are, what they're doing, okay? And this area right here is probably the most frequently imaged part of the body, because that pathology likes to develop within the layers of that blood vessel right there. because of those baroreceptors and because just the nature of this bifurcation. Okay, so that's it, I think, for this diagram. I want you to know the carotid sinus. And is it even labeled on this diagram? I don't see it. But that's something you got to know. You got to know, right, the brachiocephalic, the common, internal, external, the vertebral, subclavian, and this carotid sinus. All these other vessels, I'm not so concerned about that you know. Okay. Carotid sinus. Okay. Let's look at... All right, so let's follow blood up to the brain via the vertebrals and the internal carotid artery. And when we look at the base of the brain, this is what we see. So let me zoom into this region right here. All right, let's look at this illustration. So here we see the two vertebral arteries, right? And when they enter the cranial vault, notice that they anastomose, which means what? They join together to form the basilar artery. So here's the basilar artery, and then that goes right around the sella turcica of the sphenoid bone, and there it's going to join up with both internal common carotid internal carotid artery. So here is the internal carotid, and over here. But notice what forms between the basilar artery and the carotid arteries, internal carotids. Notice that they're all connected by this circular blood vessel right here at the base of the brain. And so this circular artery we call the circle of Willis, right, that forms a plexus of blood vessels. Right, so don't forget, the basilar formed from anastomosing of the two vertebrals. Right, so both vertebrals supply blood to the circle of Willis, and both internal carotids supply blood to the circle of Willis. So what's the beauty of having the circle of Willis right at the base of the brain? Can you tell me what is the function of a nerve plexus? What's the beauty of having nerve plexi in your body? So that you have more than one route for nerve impulses to get from your brain to the effector organ, so that you don't lose control of that effector organ, like for instance the diaphragm, right through the phrenic nerve. What are the origins of the phrenic nerve? Ooh, that could be in the test coming up. Yeah, 3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, right? So that's the origin of the phrenic nerve. Well, we have the circle of Willis here in the base of the brain because there's a lot of pathology in the carotid sinus that's going to block blood supply, maybe in one carotid but not the other. And if that carotid, it was the only vessel supplying blood to the right side of your brain, then the whole right side of your brain would die. So the circle of Willis takes blood from all four of these vessels and can redistribute it throughout your whole brain, even though one vertebral might be completely occluded or one carotid can be completely occluded. Your brain can still get oxygenated blood and survive. Okay, so the parts of that circle of Willis, I can't remember if you have to know this or not, but let's look in your notes. Mm-hmm. What do we got? Circle of Willis? Yeah, okay, but I guess I'm not asking you the parts of the circle of Willis. In lab, you might actually have to know that this is the posterior communicating artery, right, between the basilar and the internal, and then here's the anterior cerebral supplying the more anterior parts of the brain from the internal carotid. You might have to know those two parts in lab. I'm not sure. Okay. Well, let's go to the thoracic aorta. Yeah. That supply blood? Sure. Okay. Okay. Yeah, let's go look at that. What are the three? Right and left, internal carotid. That's two. And then the basilar, that's the third one. And the vertebrals feed the basilar. So the vertebrals don't directly feed the circle of Willis, only indirectly via the basilar right here because the two vertebrals anastomose. So where I have the cursor right now is really, it gets blood directly from the vertebrals, but we don't call it the vertebral artery. That's the basilar artery. Yeah, the basilar is the third one. All right, so the right and left, internal carotid and the basilar. Feed the circle of Willis directly. Okay? Okay. All right, well, let's go back to the aorta, and in particular, the descending, and even more particular, the abdominal, because I'm not going to ask you to know much in ways of the, what's coming, branches off the thoracic aorta. But the abdominal aorta has some important branches, and when we think of the descending and abdominal aorta, we want to characterize vessels that come off as paired branches as opposed to vessels that come off as a single branch. So why do you think you might have arteries that come off singularly and other arteries that branch off in pairs? How could you maybe explain that? Yeah, because for instance, some organs you have one of, and some organs you have two of. So some organs you have a pair, one bilaterally, you have one on the right side and one on the left. Like for instance, give me the name of an organ that you only have one of. Liver. That's right. So you don't need paired branches going to the liver, you just need one artery. What is another organ you only have one of?
Stomach.
Right. And so now let's think of some organs that you have pairs of. Yeah, kidneys, you got two. Gonads, reproductive organs, you have two of. All right. Adrenal glands, you have two of. Two lungs, but that's not from the abdominal aorta, right? Because that would be thoracic. All right, so let's look at these branches coming off the descending aorta. First, let's talk about the unpaired branches. There's only three, and it's not really difficult. The first branch is the celiac trunk, right? So this is going to, and you don't even have to know this, these are going to go to the stomach and the spleen, right, and the liver. You don't have to know these branches, but they all come off this celiac trunk. The next branch is the superior mesenteric, right here, that supplies the superior digestive tract, small intestine and large intestine, and then the inferior mesenteric, supplying the lower intestines. So those are the three unpaired branches. And then the paired branches, you have suprarenal arteries going to the adrenal glands, you've got the renal arteries going to the kidneys, and then you have the gonadal arteries going to ovaries or testes. So those are the ones that you have to know. So try to just break it down like that. Pelvic arteries. Yeah, let's look at the pelvic arteries real quick. All right, so after the descending aorta reaches the pelvic cavity, it bifurcates into the common iliac, just like the common carotid, okay, it bifurcates. So we have the internal iliac and external iliac. And then the external iliac, as it gets into the thigh, turns into the femoral. And as it goes behind the kneecap, we call that the popliteal. What else do you have to know? And I think that's it for lecture, okay, in terms of arteries. So don't forget, anastomosis, that's a vascular structure where vessels unite or interconnect. What's the neuronal equivalent of a vascular anastomosis? A nerve plexus? Yeah, a nerve plexus. What's the function of a vascular anastomosis? It's just so that blood can take alternate routes to get to an important vital organ when one blood vessel gets occluded. Okay. All right, so don't forget, test next time, not on blood vessels here, but up to the heart, starting with, what, central nervous system, I think. Okay? Okay, see you Wednesday. Wednesday, will you come Wednesday? All right, well, let me turn this off.